It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 142. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
I'm Keeper John, and in this episode, we dive into the Special Collections Vault to talk about tomes as story points.
I'm Keeper Murph, and we also have some great audio contributions from the MUP Nation.
Rock on.
Starting off with the Campus Crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. Here's what we're going to go through. Mythos-related news and feedback for the show. This episode is being recorded on March 29th, 2018.
So Chaosium announced last week that they will be kickstarting a new board game by Reiner Knizia and Greg Stafford. I hope I said that name right. I'm not entirely certain.
Yeah, it's called Miskatonic. Stafford.
I deserve that one. We're doing this quick. It's called Miskatonic University, the Restricted Collection. It's actually the company's first foray into the board game realm in about 37 years. And thanks to Chaosium's continued pre-launch updates, which they have sent out a lot, we have gotten looks at the game mats, and we know the Kickstarter's supposed to launch sometime in April, so right about now, maybe. Anyway, you can find links to the updates and the hopeful Kickstarter announcement here in the show notes.
Looks wicked.
Yeah. And looks something really, else they're really naming cool. After us. They love us so much.
Yeah.
We should have trademarked it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay. This just in from Brett Kramer of Sentinel Hill Press. The Arkham Gazette 2 has been raised up from its essential salts and is now available on DriveThruRPG. This issue was about Innsmouth, and for about $12, you can get a PDF with over a dozen articles and a scenario. The print version is coming soon. Also, Brett has a brand new $3 patron level on his Patreon page called Vile Minions. This will get all of the lower-level Sentinel Hill Press rewards, plus an occasional postcard, short letter, or possibly a few pages from an upcoming release. Links to find out more about both are in the show notes.
Reports are coming in that the game Raiders of Rillia, the RPG, which launched way back in August of 2013, and we covered initially on episode 38... has started showing up in people's hands over the last few days. So if you're a backer, be on the lookout. And congrats to Quentin Bauer, creator, and for finally getting this puppy out the door. That had to have been quite the painful slog, but It's out. That's fantastic.
It's out. And from what I've read so far, it's huge.
Cool.
It looks really cool, and they should, on their website, it says they should start selling them retail here soon as well.
Okay, cool.
So
I backed, but only at $1, so I'm not getting anything for it. But I'm glad to see that it's moving forward, because it was a very cool setting and great idea.
Agreed. Yeah, it's really cool. Modiphius has released a new installment of their Living campaign for Octoon Cthulhu. The scenario is called The Blessed of the Wind and is by Richard August. It centers around a Nazi troop ship that is anchored in a nearby fjord. The scenario is free and available to members of their Living campaign over at Modiphius' website. We have links in the show notes to where you can get a hold of that.
Cool. A new Kickstarter for Maximum Apocalypse Gothic Horrors Expansion for the popular card game Maximum Apocalypse. It has been funded already. It's on Kickstarter live right now and is funded in 2 hours. The expansion update will allow players to face off against life-draining vampires, ghouls, werewolves in the classic monster set, or you can try and stop a bunch of cultists from summoning Cthulhu and other unspeakable Lovecraftian horrors. At the time of recording, there is 27 days remaining to this Kickstarter, so if you're listening to this episode soon after it drops, I'm sure there's still plenty of days left. One thing I want to point out, I missed the Kickstarter when for the core set that came out last year. But if you go to this Kickstarter for this expansion, there is a backer level that will allow you to get the core set as well. In fact, if you want to, you could just back it to only get the core set, or you can back at a higher level to get the core set and a whole bunch of other stuff. That's what I think I'm going to be doing, because this looks wicked.
Yeah, it looks really cool.
Yeah, and I like that there are other expansions you can get, too.
Yeah, so I'm looking at a list here. It looks like there's a Kaiju Rising expansion.
Yeah.
There's a Jurassic Perils expansion. Uh-huh. So it looks like there's all kinds of really cool things that you can do. And this looks like it's primarily a card-driven game, but... The art is amazing and it looks great. There's a bunch of videos on the Kickstarter, so people can go and check out gameplay and see production values and stuff like that. It looks wicked.
And in the last episode, Chris Spivey mentioned that there was a comic shop in Brooklyn called Anyone Comics, and they were going to go hold a special game day for Harlem Unbound. Well, our very own Keeper Chad stopped by, and he reports that the event was very well attended, with two game tables set up in a basement room of the comic shop, and they had about a total of 15 players, which was their biggest attendance for Indie RPG Day since they started doing it last year. Chad ended up playing a four-hour session of a scenario seed from the book called Blood is Blood, and had a blast doing it. There's even a talk among some of the attendees of a spin-off local group to keep playing Harlem Unbound. And a shout out again to Anyone Comics for hosting this. Anyone who wants to check out the upcoming Indie RPG Game Days can go to our show notes and see the link for the store's Facebook page.
Also, a quick note, this show was edited by Sean. Thank you very much for editing this. We are so sorry.
Thank you, Sean.
We do our best to make it as hard as possible.
We try.
That's one thing we're actually good at. And now is the time on Ship Rockets when we play audio segments sent in by our peoples.
First up, let's open a window into ancient Roman weirdness with another dispatch from Ascarius Tabularis. This time we travel across the Mediterranean to Carthage for a parable of a marine nature.
Salve, citizens. I am Ascarius Tabularis, and this is Glimpses into the Empire. In our daily struggle to put bread on the table, it is easy to forget about the beautiful and magical world all around us. For the most part, that's a good thing, because people tend to destroy that which brings them joy. If we see a flower, we pluck it. No matter our intentions, we eventually bring ruin to the wondrous things around us. It's sad and tragic, but it is our nature. Let me tell you about the dolphin of Hippozaritis. There lived a young boy in the town of Hippozaritis, in the province of Africa, in what you people will one day call Tunisia. The boy enjoyed swimming in the ocean. One day, while swimming, he noticed a shape in the water moving all around him. The boy was more curious than cautious, so he remained in the water. Soon the strange thing swam closer and closer until it could be clearly seen. It was a dolphin. The boy began playing with his new friend from the mysterious deep. They swam together, chased one another. Eventually, the creature came close enough for the boy to touch, and then stroke, and then ride. Day after day, the boy and the dolphin played, and the dolphin eventually began coming when the boy called to it. Why did it come, and why did it stay? To this day, no one knows. I cannot help but think how brave the boy was, and how amazing this experience must have been. The people of this sleepy seaside town came to see the boy and his dolphin. I am sure at first with doubt, but then with wonder. Many took to the water with the boy in hopes of making friends with the dolphin, coaxing it closer with offerings of fish. The creature ate from their hands and proved as friendly to them as it did to the boy. For a time, magic and wonder came to their lives as they connected with something beautiful and alien and mysterious. Soon word of this spread, and people came from far and wide to see the creature. Their sleepy seaside town was not so sleepy anymore. At first, all of this attention was welcome, as the tourists brought with them coins. They rented rooms, purchased meals, and shopped for trinkets to memorialize their trip. But then the wealthy and powerful found out, and they too came to Hippozeritis to see its famous dolphin. Now, when common folk travel, they spend their own money. But when the wealthy and powerful visit some backwater town, it's a major event. Etiquette demands that the town be courteous and generous hosts. Such esteemed visitors, often with their large entourages, needed to be fed and housed and entertained, with all expenses to be paid by the local government in gratitude for their presence. Each time a noble visited Hippozeritis, the town's coffers dwindled, and they just kept coming. Soon, the town teetered on the edge of financial ruin, and they were trapped. They could not refuse to offer hospitality to the rich and powerful. It would be scandalous, leaving a black mark on their town's reputation for generations. So the town fathers met to discuss the urgent crisis and came up with a solution. This gentle, beautiful, friendly visitor from the depths, who had harmed no one, was killed on the orders of the town fathers. It had become the only way to save the town without making enemies among the Empire's elite. The town soon faded back into obscurity, and its citizens were thankful for it. But still, I think of that boy often, the one who made friends with the creature. I imagine he mourned his strange, wondrous friend. I wonder if he blamed himself. So until next time, treasure the beauty and wonder in your life, and maybe keep it secret from everyone else. Yours, in service to the Empire, Oscarius Tabularis.
So sad.
Man, those are good.
Can I just... Oscar, your production value has gone through the roof, man. I am so stoked to hear that. That is awesome.
But...
that was really cool.
The dolphin.
The poor dolphin. Dan is traumatized.
Poor Dan.
Might have to take a break.
They're just horrible people.
But it tasted good.
Mm. Oh.
Yummy, yummy.
I always like me some fried dolphin. That's really good. I like that a lot.
I did too. Thank you, Oscar. Yeah,
that was beautifully done.
Now get ready to carve some heavy metal graffiti into your desk as we head back to the detention hall for part two of Mr. Tyler's gamer-eyed view of the story Earth to Earth.
Quiet down, quiet down. You're all here in detention today for picking on that Marsh kid. He can't help his bulging eyes, flapping hands, and the strange creases on his neck. It's just a skin condition. I'm sure he'll grow out of it. Now, I don't want to be here any more than you do, so we're going to talk about what I want to talk about. For those of you who were not in detention last week, we talked about the short story Earth to Earth by Robert Graves, about a young couple whose lives are taken over by a sinister obsession for composting. Now that we have the basics down, let's go a little bit deeper. This story has lots and lots of interesting little details that could be greatly expanded into Call of Cthulhu scenarios. Let's see what we can make. First, let's get the obvious one out of the way. Compost pile, gardening, degeneration, fertility. It all speaks of Shub-Niggurath. As I mentioned before, the bacteria's recipe is called the mother. The mixture used to make it has a bull's foot and a goat's pancreas mixed in a ram's horn, which is very appropriate if we're invoking the black goat with 1,000 young. Maybe the bacteria produces Shub-Niggurath's milk. Maybe all of her followers have these compost piles in their backyard. Maybe this is how they commune with her. It could be anything. Alternatively, though, composting could be a symbol of life from death and decomposition. This suggests to me you could also use the charnel god, Mordiggian. This could be a ghoul story. After all, those bones were buried and picked clean at the end of the story. London during the Blitz is full of lost, dead bodies and fresh craters leading to the world beneath. Who knows what crawled up to the surface to feed? In the story, it seems like the hedges don't get very much out of this, but maybe it's a trade. Maybe the compost pile is a lure for the ghouls. Mordiggian makes the pact, if you feed my children, the food that is grown in this compost pile will extend your life or give you incredible powers of some kind. Or better yet, make you one of my children. The deepest well in this story, from which to draw inspiration, is the character of Dr. Eugene Steinpilt. We know so little about him. We don't know why he lures the hedges into making this compost pile. We don't know anything about him except for a few important details. The first, if you want to learn about his natural philosophy, you have to join the Eugene Steinpilt's Fellowship. We don't know what that is, but we know the hedges joined it. We also know that the hedges religiously read from a series of books he wrote, quote, "They treasured a signed collection of all his esoteric books, each titled after a different semi-precious stone, and used to read them aloud to each other at meals and turns." So this composting thing was just one thing from these books. What else is in these books? And why are they all named after precious stones? What happened to the Hedges copy? Where'd that go after they died? Sadly, we'll have to put aside our discussion of running a Bookhounds of London campaign during the Blitz, for now. We also don't know under what circumstances Dr. Eugene Steinpilt left Germany. That's kind of important during World War II. In a pulp game, Steinpilt could be a Nazi agent sent to corrupt the famous Dig for Victory campaign and to sow mythos threats in London. Or Steinpilt could be a German refugee. The Nazis quite famously cracked down on astrologers and other free thinkers who did not follow the party line. Maybe he's making a fresh start of his cult in London and looking for converts. Maybe Steinpilt isn't even human. Maybe he's a Yithian or a Migo. He could just show up in a cheap disguise with a buzzing voice and everybody says, "I say, who's that fella over there? He's got a weird accent." "Yes, I'm German." It's possible Robert Graves based the doctor on a real person. In the early 20th century, an Austrian philosopher named Rudolf Steiner helped popularize composting throughout Europe as a part of his theory on biodynamic agriculture. Steiner was a busy little bee, putting his fingers in so many diverse pies such as alternative medicine, writing plays, theosophy, architecture, education reform, and developing a new expressive movement art form called eurythmy. He's almost a universal join. You can connect any crazy thing from the early 20th century to him. In the last decade, we've seen a big movement to go back to natural foods, lots of organic foods, locally sourced foods, and so on. Just imagine if the hedges had been taking their produce to a farmer's market. Maybe they're packing up some of the bacteria from their compost pile and selling it as a Miracle-Gro or a special compost pile home kit. Or even better, imagine if Monsanto was using this stuff. As I said before, the real fun of this story is filling in the blanks. Fortunately, filling in the blanks is what coming up with role-playing game ideas is all about. Well, your detention's done. Stay out of trouble, okay?
That was really good.
I love that.
I do too.
Wow.
That was so funny. Tyler, that was awesome.
Oh, that was great. So, yes, that's... more of that, please. I would like more of that.
When's part three? That's crazy. I like the idea of the ghouls from the compost pile. Like they were using it as some sort of, I don't know, like a tunnel cover or a all-you-can-eat buffet for ghouls. It's crazy.
It's kind of like putting up a bird feeder.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's a ghoul equivalent of a bird feeder, and that's...
Or maybe it's the other direction, and it's actually the ghoul equivalent of a baited box in the woods.
Oh, it's a bug zapper.
It's a bug zapper. Like, nope, there's a ghoul problem here, and these guys know about it, and they're just ticking them off the list one at a time.
Although I do like the hint that having a compost pile may be a way to contact Shub Niggurath. I can just imagine the cultists going out there to lay down in it and just kind of be covered up in it. Just bury me just up to the neck. I'm going to commune with Mother now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they rise from the steaming compost, naked and covered in filth, as they commune with the dark great one.
I like it.
Awesome. Yeah.
I like it.
I like it a lot. So there's a link for Mr. Tyler's blog, Skullduggery and the Smoke, and we have that in the show notes as well.
Yes.
Thank you, Tyler.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So yes, up next, Jonathan has another segment on horror folklore in Japan. And in this episode, we learn about the legend of the slit-mouthed woman.
Well, that sounds just ominous.
Mm.
Thank you. In the winter of 1978, in Yaotsu, Gifu Prefecture, Japan, an old lady was found rooted in fear one evening after seeing a suspicious figure wandering the streets. She could only be identified as a woman in a thick red overcoat, with long black hair and one other defining feature, a large surgical mask covering the lower part of her face. The prefectural paper picked up the story in January 1979, with the national paper, the Asahi Weekly, bringing the story to the national stage in May of that year. Sightings of this figure began to spread to the neighboring Aichi Prefecture, where children began to report similar sightings. In Japan, it is very common for people to wear surgical masks every day, particularly to stave off bacteria or hay fever, or to signal to others that you may have a cold as a sign of courtesy. Yet, the surgical mask only added more fuel to this particular mystery, making children's imaginations run wild. They began to speculate that such a figure may be malevolent, otherworldly, and hiding something beneath the mask. Some said that beneath the mask lay a ghastly Glasgow smile, her mouth split open from ear to ear, perhaps from a jealous lover. Others said it was a vengeful spirit from the Edo period, a woman of unmatched beauty and vanity from a former life, who paid the price for her pride by a samurai who cut her mouth wide open. Whether a poor victim driven to madness, or an angry spirit returned from ages past, this figure roamed the streets of Japan looking to exact her revenge on young people, especially children. It was from these stories that the figure got her name, the Kuchi Sake Onna, or the slit-mouthed woman. Rumors say that late at night, you may be approached by a woman wearing a surgical mask, asking a single question.
Watashi... kirei?
Am I beautiful? If answered yes, she lowers her mask to reveal her mouth slit from ear to ear, exposing her teeth and oral cavity in full view. She would then ask,
Kore demo?
Even now? If you answered yes once more, she will then proceed to give you the same broad smile with a pair of scissors or a knife. If you answer no to either question, she will kill you where you stand. Running from her is impossible, as it is said that her speed is inhuman, as she can reach up to 100 yards in 3 seconds, or even appear behind you in an instant. As the rumors and speculation spread throughout the prefectures, minor details such as the extent of her powers would change, as well as the ways to which one can escape the encounter or defend oneself against her. Methods varied from tossing hard candy, her favorite treat, to calling out the word pomade, a kind of hair gel, 3 times, a word that reminds her of the smell of her former lover. The waves upon waves of speculation became such a problem that it led to social hysteria in 1979, with schools in Hokkaido and Saitama prefectures warning students to go home in groups rather than alone, and police stations in Kanagawa and Fukushima prefectures increasing their nightly patrols. This did not help matters much, as children typically would go to cram schools after regular school hours to study further, and only returned home after dark. In August of 1979, children were forbidden to speak of the Kuchi Sake Onna, but that did not make the children feel any safer at night, and only led to more speculation away from the ears of adults. The legend was pushed even further into the social consciousness by comics and magazines that capitalized on the phenomenon. To this day, no one knows the identity of the Kuchi Sake Onna. Sightings have died down in recent years, but the memory of the social hysteria she caused still lingers in the Japanese consciousness, becoming an enduring urban legend. Even her infamous question still sparks recognition, and the particular hair gel pomade is still associated with her. Stories and theories continue to spring up from time to time as to what she may have been. The CIA tests to see how stories and rumors spread throughout communities, to an escaped insane asylum patient, to a particular coroner's report from the 1970s that was found in 2007, of a woman chasing children who was hit by a car and killed. Her mouth was found ripped open, but whether it was from the car or not is unknown. Sightings of a similar figure have recently been reported in Korea, and even as far as the United States. Wherever she is, there's no doubt that she may still be asking the same question to children, even now.
Watashi kitty.
Yeah, that's super creepy. I love it.
That is creepy as hell, and I love it, man.
Yeah. I've heard of that one before, and she's just a...
I think it would be awesome, too, if used in a game and you describe how this person approaches, and the surgical mask is just slightly stained. Like, there's some sort of, like, filth stain, and it would be so disturbing to have that right on your face, you know? You would expect it would be clean.
Or just like a white surgical mask with like a few little spots, little tiny spot flecks of red, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
just freak you out, man. Yeah, that is really cool. I could use that in a game.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you, Jonathan.
And I think I would steal his audio to play the questions whenever. That was really cool, man. Yeah, good job,
the Japanese
Jonathan.
Definitely know how to make creepy, creepy kid stories.
Yeah, for sure.
To keep them in line.
All right, now that I've told you, so, good night. Sleep well.
Hope the slip mouth woman doesn't come and grab you in the middle of the night, hon.
The window's unlocked. Yep.
It'll be okay. Yeah. Good Lord. Love it.
Yeah, that was wicked. Awesome.
The reference librarians locate various materials through their familiarity with the contents of the library.
And just for a quick card catalog here, we have a submission from good buddy Graham. He says, "Hey guys, I've stumbled across an archive site devoted to comic books that fell into the public domain. Thought it might make a useful addition to the card file. The comics can be viewed online, but you need to register to the site if you want to download them." And so, yeah, public domain comic books. There's got to be all sorts of cool, weird stuff in there to mine from.
Oh, dude, this is crazy cool.
Yeah, I bet there's some good horror stuff in there.
Oh, they have it breaks down by categories and by collections, so you can choose horror.
And publishers.
If I choose horror, what do we get? Adventures in Darkness, Adventures into the Unknown, Ghost Stories, Baffling Mysteries. This is crazy.
This is awesome.
Black Magic Magazine. This is so cool. Weird Tales of Terror.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, this is the comixology of public domain books.
Yeah, this is awesome. I wonder what they look like. I'm going to look at one real quick just because. Forbidden Worlds number 1 from 1951. Oh, wow, they're big scans too, man.
Oh, cool. So nice and big and legible.
Yeah, they're huge.
Cool.
Yeah, they're really high-res scans. They look really, really good. The Demon of Destruction. That's awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you, Graham.
Thank you so much. This is quite the treasure trove of pulpy goodness.
Yeah, no kidding, dude. You could keep this going forever.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that'll be worth digging through later.
That's awesome. Thanks, Graham.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, man.
Now remember, for security reasons, we have to lock readers in. Special Collections Room. Good luck with your research.
And now into the main topic. We're going to spend a little more time just riffing, because we really enjoy it. And so here's what we came up with as a general discussion topic of that. Talking about tomes discussion and how they can be used in ways other than just as like a piece of treasure that your character finds. You know, it's something that is an actual story point in some way. Does it give clues to the motivations of NPCs? Does it actually give an idea of what might be happening in the future? You know, what all can we do with that?
Yeah, also, I think we'll talk about what a tome actually is as well. And what I think everyone assumes it to be an old leather-bound book, you know, that you find on a shelf somewhere. But I think we can maybe expand on that a little bit as well.
So, pretty much every Call of Cthulhu scenario that, at least that is the type that you would start off your gameplay with, has something in it that counts as a tome, from The Haunting on up.
Yeah, and sometimes some of the bigger ones, you have multiple tomes.
Yeah. You know, The Haunting actually was one that I really liked the way it did it, because you found that book, and it was in such terrible condition, it was completely unreadable.
Yep.
But you knew it was something special, because it was chained to a desk.
Yes. And what's interesting about that one in The Haunting is that nothing... That tome contains nothing that the investigators need for that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely something that you can kind of put in your pocket and use as a bridge into a follow-up scenario, that if you wanted to make The Haunting something to kick off a campaign, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's tricky, because sometimes... you know, if you're kind of following, and granted, there is a lot of latitude in how a keeper can adjudicate how long it takes to get in certain, you know, levels of information out of a tome. If you wanted to include a tome into a scenario and then have it as a linchpin clue, you know, the players, the investigators need that info in order to get deeper into the mystery and have any chance at solving that mystery. You know, you need to, unless you're working in a scenario that has a strange expanded timeline, you know, most players are, I feel, they assume that everything needs to happen, you know, pretty damn quick, you know, so you want to be able to read a tome in hours, not weeks, and get what you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing I've done on previous games, of that, you know, starting off with The Haunting, that the book found in that, the player characters actually, like, had it with some specialists to try and restore it to at least a somewhat legible state. And so just eventually down the line, I was going to say, okay, here's as much of it as they get, and here's the title, and here's some basics, and now you can read through it. And yeah, it's kind of weird that assistant at our place that does a lot of the restoration just sort of disappeared.
Right. I was going to ask if he went nuts, because it seems like that's the next
That's,
you know what I mean?
That guy becomes like a major antagonist later on, because then he's trying to get the book back.
Right. For some reason, Robert's bookbindery went out of business right after they got this book. It was the last one he did.
Hm. Yeah, right after he finished rebinding that book, Robert was arrested for murdering his family and going on a killing spree. He was such a quiet guy.
He ate a boatload of kindergartners.
Yep.
It's always that the quiet happens. Ones.
Never would have known. So, John, have you used them any kind of weird way, at least, or away from the norm?
I have, well, kind of tying it into also what is a tome. I've used diaries, and I've tried to string together like multiple diary entries, so that if you put all the pieces together, there was a larger clue to be found. I've also used ledger books, like you know, accounts receivable, accounts payable, kind of things, you know, and had ledgers that math was used as the language to create. As an equation, it was going to become the spell.
Kind of thing. It's very laundry files-esque in that
yeah.
scenario, at least.
Yeah, you know, I actually think I got that idea after listening to you talk about the laundry files, Murph. I was like, that's a really cool idea. I think I want to try and do that.
It worked. I've had that idea as well. I've tried stealing that from them and using that in a game to where math is the primary function as opposed to the words on the page. And so then you can kind of take that to different heights. Like the Laundry Files RPG game does that at its best in that situation, at least, where they take a bunch of equations, and then they're equations that are tied to functions and programs, which now you can have on your phone and stuff like that. So you can cast a spell by tapping a phone or an icon on your smartphone, which I think is interesting, but it's not quite a tome at that point either, though, is it?
Yeah, it's kind of a definition that whether or not you want something to fit within the realm of what you could call a tome. I think of it as basically some level of information carrying module that it will reveal those Lovecraftian cosmic secrets to whoever is able to read it or unlock
I would that think
information.
That going to Lovecraft's story, The Call of Cthulhu, Professor Angel's briefcase and the box that contained all the articles and the notes and his firsthand analysis and analysis picked up from interviews and things like that. Collectively, I would consider that a tome because of the information that it carries.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
I like that.
I think also, in a modern day scenario, I think it would be cool if somebody just had either like a blog, or what I was thinking of though is a Google document that was just a tome. Like if you read the whole thing, you're mm-hmm. screwed, or even part of it, mm-hmm. it takes time to read just like everything else does. So why not have that digitized in some form mm-hmm. or fashion?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I could write this, but, I was just thinking that, it might be a neat scenario to kind of modern day kind of hypothesize. We've seen how Barnes & Noble tried to launch the Nook, and I don't know if it's still a thing or not. It doesn't seem like the Nook is a thing, but what if the Nook was trying to be launched by cultists and people that we don't know about, they were successful in thwarting the spread of the Nook into the general population, because it contained mythos knowledge that would have, contaminated the general public.
I think it had the Bezos manifesto in it, and so it was feared by all.
That would have been the Kindle.
Well, maybe that was the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That one's still around.
So what about using tomes as opposed to like in The Haunting, where it's a side item, mm-hmm. Especially in The Haunting, because it's not even pivotal to the story at all.
There is also a diary in that, which is more useful and does have spells in it and that sort of thing. So that's like a miniature tome.
True. Yes. The neighborhood parents.
Right.
Kind of compiled information. Yeah.
Well, plus there was the actual diary, I think, in the house of.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. The diary in the house.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely a tome.
Yeah.
But what about having a tome as an actual, the actual center focus of the scenario? Mm-hmm. Like, everything is revolving around. How would you do that? Is that possible to do that?
Well, there's Bookhounds of London that's all based around that kind of idea. It's the hunt of finding tomes. And although I don't think I have Bookhounds, I'm not sure how much of it involves actually the reading of the tomes or the acquiring of them. So that part I'm not too sure of, but I like the idea.
I had wondered about giving a tome some sort of sentience.
Yeah.
Like a D&D cursed object?
Yeah, kind of like a cursed object. So you find a tome, you know, early on in a game, and it doesn't, it's either in a language that they can't understand, or it's for some reason they just don't find it useful immediately, so they put it down and just ignore it for a little bit. But then the tome starts just popping up in different places. Like, oh, well, he left it in his bedroom. Well, now it's on the dinner table. You know, and it not all the time, but just every so often. Or it always changes pages when you turn around. Like, if you're reading it, you're on page 130, and you turn around and look at something else, and you come back, you're on page 245. You know, like, it's got its own agenda that it's trying to get you to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
That's cool. As you were talking, I just had this idea of also a sentient tome, and the pages, you know, as you're looking at the pages, they seem out of focus. Like, you can tell there's something there, but it's almost like if you're ever looking at a book that has thin, poor quality paper, and you can almost kind of see the bleed through imaging of text that's on the opposite side of the page, right? So you're looking at this book and you keep flipping the pages back and forth, and you're like, gosh, I feel like there's something there, but it's slightly out of focus. And then maybe a paper cut. Now the user has dropped blood onto the page, and that page drinks up the blood, and now the writing surfaces to the top of the page and is now readable, right? And so now you're having to donate blood to this book and have pages focus in and become readable. And as you read certain pages, it's sending you out on like different missions or something, you know, that, you know, to acquire certain things. I don't know. I'm just kind of spitballing that, but I had this image suddenly come to my head of the pages that are out of focus, and as you add blood to it, they gain focus and clarity.
Yeah, that's a cool idea.
Yeah, and one thing that also kind of came to mind was another example I've seen of a book used in other media that in, I think it was last season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they actually had a Mythos tome called The Darkhold.
I have not seen it.
Yeah, me neither. Tell me more.
Tell me more.
This is basically a book that it looks just like what we would expect from a Mythos tome. It's just this big, thick leather thing with clasps and stuff. And when you first open it and glance at the pages, they're just empty. Then you might blink and look away and look back, and now they're filled with whatever your native language is.
Oh, I like that.
And different people could be looking at it at the same time, and it simply is in whatever language they are best at reading. And it will provide whatever information is most coveted by that person.
Ooh.
The book reads you.
I like that.
And so it goes for the corruption as quickly as possible. And it becomes kind of, in the episodes that I saw, it was sort of an addictive sort of thing.
Well, I can see why.
Yeah. Where, you know, scientists got hold of it and it was giving him, like, the secrets of the universe kind of stuff. And it was, pretty cool, actually, having this thing.
Now, in game terms, you could do the same thing, only have it eating POW at the every time you read a page.
And so, yeah, I found the Wikipedia article on the Darkhold, and apparently it was written in the Marvel Universe by a being called C'thon.
Oh, come on.
A demonic elder god who was the Earth's first practitioner of black magic. And so, yeah, this is actually directly tied to a Marvelization of the mythos.
That is cool.
That's cool.
Yep.
I was thinking about John's idea of having a ledger, like the old school ledger books, like John mentioned, only every time you look at it, it has a new line entry added. So you look once, it's a blank page. You know, you go and do something, and then you maybe come back to it a little while later, and there's a new line filled in. But what it fills in is something that needs to be done, like what the book wants to have done. Like, you know, mundane things at first. Tells you to do, like, take the trash out tomorrow morning. And you take the trash out, and for some reason or other, you find, like, a $10 bill in the side of the, you know, inside the pages or something. It just kind of ups the ante every single time. So towards the end, you're like, oh, I need to sacrifice a virgin. All right, what do I get for that, I wonder? Let's go try it out and see, guys. You know what I mean? Just try and up the ante every single time there.
That's awesome. Yeah. I like that.
What else? There was something else I had in my head.
Well, so something I was also thinking about is language. So the language that the tomes are written in,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm thinking about for gameplay that you could have it so that if you're an investigator is able to read the tome in its written language, then there's a certain level of benefits that can be gained or possibly gained to that investigator for using the correct language. But if there's any kind of like, well, we need to convert it, you know, let's go and get, you know, this is written in Latin, let's go to the library and get a English to Latin translation kind of book and use it as an intermediary, you know, that would start watering down the information that comes through. And so it might be interesting to give lesser information. And that actually could be a benefit to the investigators, you know, that there's less sanity to lose, you know, less effective version of certain spells, or maybe even certain spells aren't available, lower amount of Cthulhu Mythos to be had, because you're not getting, you know, you're not drinking from the tap, you know, that it's filtered water.
Yeah. Summon Dagon turns into attract fish.
Right.
So you don't have to,
right.
You don't die exactly. Immediately.
Yeah.
I think you could stack that as well, because a lot of, if we use the typical tome, quote unquote, right. The old mm-hmm. book that was written by some crazy guy. A lot of times those were actually written in code to start with because historically the Inquisition was after people who would write things like that anyway. And so they would create alphabets and use it, and you had to be in the know to know the mm-hmm. alphabet. Well, then if we found that book, we would have to translate that code into its native language and then from its native language back into English. Yeah. And so there's a double translation happening there.
Which can be a lengthy, painstaking process in the case of the Voynich manuscript.
Right. Exactly. Like, never. You know? So, I mean, there's that. And then if you do get it, then like John said, it's seriously degraded the effectiveness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is actually one of the reasons why there's 15 copies of the Necronomicon, if we get onto that.
Yeah.
Because the original is like sanity blasting and mm-hmm. craziness. But then over time, more and more copies have been made. And every time somebody makes a copy, mistakes are made because they were hand done up until very, very recently. And each time it degrades slightly over, you know,
right.
It gets less and less effective to where we end up with the Simon Necronomicon on the bookshelf out
and
there.
And so I'm actually in the Keeper book. And on page 230, and I'm looking at the Necronomicon entries, and it's interesting that, you know, we have the Al-Azif original in Arabic, we've got the translated version in Greek,
mm-hmm.
A translated version in Latin, and then a translated version in English, you know, the John Dee, and all four of these versions of the Necronomicon, they all have a 2d10 sand loss. But the Cthulhu Mythos is slightly different, but only
right.
But only slightly.
Yeah, it's only slightly different.
Yeah, I think I might, adjust this a little bit. Maybe bring the Al-Azif up, make it a little more dangerous, you know, higher sand loss, but higher Cthulhu Mythos, you know, rewards, that kind of thing. Maybe lower the John D. English one, you know, not quite as sanity blasting, not quite as rewarding in Mythos. Mm-hmm. Maybe leave Latin and Greek alone, you know, that kind of thing. Just to kind of enhance the richness of language, you know?
Yeah. Plus, I would also come take into terms of what was the translation based on. Are we doing a translation of a translation or a translation of the original?
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it's like a third generation VHS dub.
Yep. I mean, it looks like it looks like it's possible that maybe the Latin and the well, and also based on dates, you know. So it looks like maybe the Greek was a translation of the original Al-Zif. It's possible the Latin was a translation of the Al-Zif, but it seems more likely that they may have been a translation of the Greek.
Yeah, most likely.
And then certainly the English would have been a translation of the Latin.
But no, it says, it literally says that Dees was a translation of the Greek. Oh,
version of the Greek. Yeah, it says version. Yeah.
And then the Sussex, which, yeah, the Sussex is actually a translation of the Latin, but it's a crappy translation, which is why it's not as effective. It's only a 1d6 sand.
Yeah, it's really
low. So this would be like if we tried to translate the Latin to English, we would end up with this book. Whereas as a professional, we end up with the John Dee.
Yes.
Yeah, and I like that degradation over time of translational generations.
Yeah, I think it would have been, I think if I was to add the Necronomicon into my game, I think I would adjust sand loss and Mythos rewards to account for degradation of translation.
Mm-hmm. I would be tempted to make it more like the El Azif is something that is potential for the characters to get, but the most complete copy has been split up into multiple segments.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, you found pages, you know, 40 through 75, and that's people could be then attacking them to get those, which leads them on a trail on where to find others.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, what was the name of the flipping movie with Johnny Depp? I forgot the name.
12th Gate?
Yeah, the 12th Gate. Where essentially that was the whole premise. There was the one page, there was those pages that were cut out, and he had to find those pages within that, the nine gates, was that?
Yeah, might be nine. It's ninth, been a long time. The ninth gate. But, and each page was like a little different for each copy.
Well, he found, what he ended up finding were the reproduction pages that someone put out there to fool people. And then at the very end, he came up with the actual original pages that were the real deal, but that someone had hidden away forever. So I think that's interesting as well, that's a possibility as well. Maybe this book has already been intercepted via whatever means, and investigators in a previous generation have already corrupted it so that it's no longer dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be kind of cool that you're actually almost undoing what a previous investigation team did.
Right.
Like, maybe even, like, an Invictus team or something.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. Yeah, that, you know what? Actually, because Call of Cthulhu has now we've got so many rich eras that we can play in. Invictus and Gaslight and, you know, Dark Ages and modern and future. You could make a tome, the central focus of a series campaign. Of adventures of a campaign that expands across time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that would be awesome. Where the first game takes place in Invictus time in ancient Rome, the next one would be up in the Dark Ages.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that would be crazy. And the central theme to each one is the same book.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the exact same book, you know. So, and if you play it in time order, you know, you move it forward in time and don't play with flashbacks. Any in-game changes or adjustments that one party does to the book carry forward, to the next timeline, you know, when the next group gets to encounter that book. You know, unless the book can heal itself somehow.
Well, we can take into concept the type of what a book is now as well, because once we get past modern day, up to modern day and beyond, maybe it's no longer just a book. Maybe it's been digitized and you can just drop it from the cloud somewhere and read it wherever the hell you want to.
I was thinking, as John was describing that, that made me think of the Lament configuration from the Hellraiser series.
Oh, yeah.
It kept kind of coming back regardless of what you did. I mean, at the end of one of them, a woman, like, shoved it into the wet cement of a building foundation, and it wound up changing the building itself later.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, yeah, I think a book that behaved kind of in that way would be pretty neat.
Something that I've read about in an adventure that I hopefully will see the light of day someday is a book that's also, you know, sort of this evil tome that has also been illuminated later by other cultists that followed it. You know, how would maybe an illumination to a tome alter or enhance the Mythos footprint that's on it, you know?
Yeah. Footnotes that denote the spell worked it whenever I did it this way, or pronunciation guides and things like that.
Or just images of what you're summoning and, you know, maybe having an image for the caster to hold in their mind will make it for a more clear or more successful
or
casting.
Or it's a disinformation campaign.
Yeah.
And so all of those illuminations are actually completely fictitious. So
booby
you think,
traps.
Oh, look, we're going to summon Narlos Adept. This is supposed to be a flower-headed god who will give us whatever we want. And he looks so cute. Look at him. And then you summon up a 10-story tall, you know, gaping mauled beast that just wants to step on you.
Or the idea of it being more of a booby trap where they, in order to keep other people from using, you know, their book, they put footnotes in there that somebody could use in a ceremony that would completely make it go sideways.
On the same note, what if it had been tied to specific cults over time? So taking John's idea of the time hopping and your idea for the footnotes thing, what if each segment of the game, so like Invictus, and it was a certain cult that was in possession of the book that the investigators had to fight to get it back from, well, those guys left their own notations in the book. Well, then you skip ahead to the Dark Ages, and now some Germanic tribe has got a hold of the book, and they're doing cultisty things, and you got to go in and stop them. Well, now they've added their own footnotes as well. So as you get further and further in, you've got all of these, you've got this primary book text, but then you've got like 1,000 years worth of crazy annotated footnotes written in 5 or 6 different languages, some of which you have no idea are. And you've got to make these decisions. Okay, this spell has, it's in Greek. We can translate it, sure. But there are 15 footnotes on it in 6 different languages. And it, do we do this or not? Because I can't translate all of these. You know what I mean? It just kind of adds another layer to that. Like, should we bother? Or is this too dangerous? Or are they just saying it's really, really good? And then hopefully people just botch a bunch of rolls and they translate poorly.
Yep.
You also could have the idea of a family lineage. You could have notes and names in there, kind of like the family Bible idea with generations being documented.
Why not a family Bible? Is my question.
Yeah.
One of those giant old huge ones that you see in antique stores nowadays is the only place that has them.
Yeah, but it's, you know, a thing for Azathoth or Yog-Sothoth or something instead.
So another idea is, and this was common in the 18th century, was writing in secret ink, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So what if it was just like a a copy of something like Thomas Paine's Common Sense, right? It's a first edition of Thomas Paine's Common Sense. But if you know how to bring the text out, it's actually like one of the lost revelations of Glocky or something, you know?
Yeah, they just used what was at hand in order to transcribe.
Yeah, they just used what was at hand, and this book has been floating through people's libraries for decades, and no one's known it. Now you've kind of come across it, and there it is.
I like that.
I was speaking of code. I was thinking a few minutes ago about World War II and the Enigma machine, and would the information that it collects and translates, do you think something like that could be considered tome information? You know, the use of a device for information.
Well, like a phone from the laundry files, even? Or are you saying?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. I guess. Yeah. Because you know, I was thinking about pre
Yeah, but see, the Enigma machine, you literally gave it numbers and it spit out digits. You know, I mean, that's so. I mean, it didn't have this access to like what we do now. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
But if somebody used that in order to
translate
or encode a mythos tome, it infuses into the machine.
Oh, now like that. That's crazy.
It starts spitting out its own coded messages that no one knows where they originated from.
Oh, yeah. They're coming from the dreamlands.
What if it's just Narlathotep just hitting a Morse code tapper somewhere?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And it's like, we've got just a new communicator.
Giggling to himself.
It's Magenta Indigo. It's time.
I like that. Anything that comes down to Nyarlathotep screwing with people, it makes for fun.
Always.
One of the few of them that has a sense of humor.
It's a twisted sense of humor, but it is a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's messed up, but at least he's got one.
Yeah, I like being able to use tomes in interesting ways. So there's a lot of flexibility with tomes.
Yep. You know, and I like the idea of having the idea of a book or document and then a cipher. So, you know, the old kids club decoder ring that decodes, you know, just the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
What if instead of a tome, what if it's the entire library? So, and bear with me here. So, you know how in the Cold War, Russian spies, British spies, everybody would do it. They would pick a particular volume unused out of the library, and then they would go to a certain page, and given the keyword for the day, they would circle certain letters on that page, and that was their way that they checked in.
Yeah.
Right? And then they put the book back on the shelf. Somebody else would come by the next day. They'd pick the book up. They'd record the words that were, or the letters that were recorded. They knew the day of the word for yesterday. They would decode it, erase the numbers out of the page, put it back up, and there's your book, right? So what if instead, though, this primary book would just used as references by someone to where they hid other pages of a particular book throughout the entire library? In one of these huge university libraries that have multiple floors and nobody ever sees 90% of those books in the first place. So it's, you know, you find this one book and it's got all these notations in it and little certain words, this weird code maybe that leads you to a certain floor, to a certain rack, to a certain shelf, to a certain book. And then you go to that book and you flip through and you find one single leaf page of some crazy book. And then you've got one. Now you can go back and try and get another one.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, that's quite the scavenger hunt.
Yeah.
And as soon as somebody else finds out that one of those pages has been found, then the chase is on.
Right. As soon as the original cult finds out that one of those pages has been found.
Yep. Then you just got a big old target.
You could do it in a place like the like one of the Antheneums, you know, Providence or something like that. One of the old libraries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, with part of the basement goes down to stone.
Yeah.
A bibliothèque.
Yeah, where the books can't leave anyway, so they're always there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pages just kind of fit in. You don't notice one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that a lot.
So does binding. So if we're looking at just traditional books, does binding matter? Would unusual or interesting binding grant any bonuses or enhancements for investigators that are in possession of that book? Does physical possession have any effects in gameplay? Does the binding do anything? So is there a difference between a human skin bound copy of the Necronomicon versus cardback or leather bound version?
I think the only difference for me would be the resources available to the original cultist.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the information in the same, if we're still talking about the same exact book in both scenarios.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just wondering if as keepers, do you think it would be, is there any reason to highlight the binding? You know, would you grant any kind of bonuses or, you know, anything for having one type of copy versus over another?
Maybe one is physically worth more than the other.
Okay.
So the older leather bound 300-year-old copy is much more valuable than the trade paper version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Sure.
In that sense. But then there's also the, like, I think it was the, I think it is the Revelations of Glocky were actually folio editions. So they were,
yeah.
You know, some of them were subscription only. And then the Narcotic manuscripts which were actually like manually bound manuscripts that were written?
Yeah, they were loose leaf.
Yeah. And then people added to them later or something. I think that was the Narcotic. Maybe I'm off on the wrong one, though. But then I know the relay attacks, that was actually stone or clay tablets originally that they transferred to scrolls because the originals broke or broke very soon afterwards.
Right.
So, I mean, there is a variety of binding already involved that in what we have in the core rulebook right now. But I don't know that I don't think I would grant a certain bonus to the book or the player because they found an older version. If the texts are the same.
Okay.
I mean, if there is a difference in text, then sure. Like the difference between the Sussex manuscript and, you know, John Dee's version, the insides are totally different as well. But if it's the same text, then I don't see a difference between having one or the other.
Okay.
Except for maybe bragging rights.
Right. Okay. So then pivoting a little bit, what about smell? You know, old books have that amazing smell, that antique smell, which actually, I don't know if this is true or not. I thought I had heard one time that that book odor is actually the smell of the decay, page decay or something. I don't know if that's true or not.
It's the smell of the fungus or the algae that's growing on the outside cover and the outside edge of the pages.
Oh, well, that's all right.
So, you can actually get rid of it as well with a very light solution and rubbing it with a Q-tip.
I don't think I'm going to do that to my books.
Well, I have some that have that odor so strongly that you can almost not open them. I have tried to remove said. That's the only reason I know this, is I have tried to remove that odor because it's too much.
But do you think a copy of the Necronomicon that that has that odor, you know, is there something that can be transferred? You know, is there something, any evil in the odor?
Perhaps the algae itself that's producing it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Maybe it's a Shoggoth fungus or something.
Oh, that just sounds wrong, man. That's a scenario seed in its own right.
Yeah, sapient toe jam.
Oh, fudge. Come on, man. Sapient toe jam. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That sounds like a 50s horror flick, you know, a B-horror movie right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Roger Corman presents Sapient Toe Jam.
Yeah.
In stunning 3D.
I'll take one on Blu-ray.
I know you would.
Yeah. One thing that I wanted to bring up, that as John was going on about the idea of the binding being something, that brought to my mind, have either of you guys seen Shin Godzilla?
Yes.
Not yet, but I want to.
Okay. You should.
It's so good.
It's good.
Yeah. I know about it, and yes, I want to see it. And there's a great music video out there, Monster by... I forget the name. I think it's actually a Christian rock band, but it is, yeah, it's got scenes from Shin Godzilla, and it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy that created up a document that it had, like, it was his research on the creation of Godzilla, and no one could understand what the hell this was. It was just this one single giant sheet of paper.
Right.
And they figured out, oh, it's legible when you fold it. When you fold it as origami, then it becomes something. Otherwise, it's just this jumbled mass.
Yeah, it was crazy. That was a really cool twist, too, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
That's a good idea.
That as a mythos tome.
Yeah, instead of having to translate it, you physically have to figure out the correct origami fold in order to get it legible.
Yep. You could have just broken pieces of letters scattered throughout the thing. And it could be dozens of pages, depending on the way that it's folded.
And the simplified version of that are the Al Jaffe cartoons at the back of every Mad magazine. I love it.
Oh,
all right.
You could bring it back to the Hellraiser theme at that point.
Yeah.
Like, What if you get it to a certain position, a certain origami fold, where the words become, it becomes almost sentient of itself, and it takes on folding itself.
It becomes a gate.
It becomes a gate, literally.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
That's crazy. Well, that'd be fun, though, wouldn't it? And then you're trying to outwit the gate.
Make it stop!
We gotta close the gate. We're going to split the party in two. Half you guys are going to just stay here and kill everything that comes through, and me and John are going to go over there and see if we can figure out how to close this thing.
Take lots of dynamite.
We'll be back eventually, I promise. Never come back.
Yeah. Turns out, they needed rebreathers for that side of it. Oh, well.
Darn.
But, yeah, that was a thing that came to my mind that I'm like, ooh, that would be fun to have players try and figure out. Because then that gives you the opportunity to make a prop.
Yeah, that would be a cool prop if you could get it made right.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think about also in French Revolution times, there was a lot of authors who were imprisoned in the Bastille, and they would write... They weren't given pen and paper, obviously. I mean, they're in the Bastille. They're screwed. But they would write books, like serious books, on scraps of paper or pieces of clothing, linen that they had found. And they would use everything from their blood to fecal matter, anything that they could in order to manufacture ink so that they could actually write it. What if you found something like that, that was like a... strange coat or a shirt from the French Revolution that had all of this crap written in blood on the inside of it, and very, very tiny, tiny little script written with a needle, and you know what? Just
there's
very,
your first edition of the Yellow King.
Yes, the very first edition, dude. Everyone's wondered where it was.
There you go. But yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways you can bring it. I don't think it has to be just a physical book at all times. You know, it can also be all sorts of other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked what Dan said earlier about how a tome isn't really a book. It's just it's a conveyance for information.
Agreed. And I like the way John's idea of having the book as a central focus on a time-hopping campaign where the only thing between games and time periods is the same individual copy of a book.
Yeah.
That's a really cool idea.
Yep. And you just have to have some sort of fail-safe in the back of your mind because, well, some group is going to just throw it in like fire.
Right. It can't be destroyed.
Yeah, I think you take it to the sentient part a little bit, and so mm-hmm. the book is semi-aware, and if it cannot, it won't let it happen, or if it does happen, it just shows back up, and you just plot-ploy that back into the reality.
Like flames initiate a gate spell that...
Yeah, it could also be... I'm not saying it's the Ithians, but it's Ithians. the Ithians are ensuring that the book is available for investigators in the correct time period to interface with it to, you know, on a stage by stage basis, slowly chip away at the evil that's growing.
What if the book actually contains instructions to do a giant summoning, right? But each part has to be done at particular times. And I don't mean like times of day. I mean like times in the millennia.
Yeah.
Right.
Centuries
when certain
apart.
Stars are in certain positions, and this whole cult or other race is just there to ensure that the book A survives and B humans are dumb enough to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The stars will be right 5 times. And so we need you to do it on each of those times.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That's really cool. That's the basis of John's game right there.
All right, I'm going to take notes and actually start trying to write that.
Which also makes me think once again, well, that's also kind of the origins of Hydra. it was like hundreds of years past on an inhuman that was super powerful and looked very Cthonian and was exiled out to another planet. And Hydra's whole purpose was to bring him back. And over the years, it was changed.
I don't think they stole that from anyone either, though.
Fail Hydra.
Fail Hydra.
I think that's a good discussion. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
I like it.
I think so.
I liked that episode. That was fun.
Hopefully people can find some useful nuggets in there and unleash them upon their players and have some fun.
Yeah, and if you do it, let us know.
Yeah, we'd love to hear stories that you took a piece of an idea from one of us and, you know, crafted it into something that you smacked the players upside the head like a giant dead fish.
For sure.
We want to hear from our listeners. We have lots of ways for you to reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a liner, tell us who you are, and give us a hearty Go Pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/142.
Thanks for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.
And now is the time on Shabrockets when we play audio segments sent in by our peoples.
I don't know if we have a bumper for that, but that's it now.
Somebody save that.
Somebody typed that into the notes. Time on Sprockets when we play segments. So